Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is Dr. Rich Savin-Williams. Dr. Savin-Williams is Professor and Chair of Human Development at Cornell University. So why don't you stick around and join us as we discuss teenagers with sexual attraction to others of the same sex. To reach us with your questions and comments, in Anchorage, you can reach us at 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@kska.org. Dr. Savin-Williams is, as I said, Professor and Chair of Human Development at Cornell. He received a PhD at the University of Chicago. He's written a number of books about adolescent development, particularly with regarding gay teenagers. And he co-edited a book with Ken Cohen of an undergraduate textbook on the lives of lesbians, gays, bisexuals, and children to adults. He's a licensed clinical psychologist with a private practice that specializes in identity, relationship, and family issues among sexual minority young adults. And he's been a consultant for MTV, the Oprah Winfrey Show, 2020, and so forth, and has been cited a number of times in the popular press. Dr. Savin-Williams, it's a real pleasure for you to take the time and joining us today.
It's good to be here.
Let's begin with some definitions. So what do we mean when we hear the words or use the words gay, lesbian, bisexual, and even straight?
Well, usually what we mean is that we ask young people or adults, how do you identify? And we give them very limited choice, usually gay, lesbian, bisexual, and heterosexual or straight. We're not always quite sure what they mean by those terms. When they so identify, some scientists have increasingly begun not to use the identity labels so much as to talk more about what are your attractions, your sexual attractions to males, what are your sexual attractions to females, or behavior or desires or fantasies or your romantic feelings. So when you measure it that way, you get more of a spectrum or a continuum, if you will, rather than sort of discrete categories.
Yeah, that's interesting. I hadn't quite thought about it, although it makes a lot of sense. Science is all about being kind of precise, but you also got to anticipate what the other individual means. And when you use those terms, it may not be that both individuals are thinking of it as the same term. I know when I talk about wheezing with a mother and say, does their child wheeze? I demonstrate wheezing, so I know exactly, because I've found that they often have different interpretations of that word.
Well, and increasingly, some scientists are beginning to expand beyond the sort of the three, gay, bisexual, and straight. They're now including words such as mostly straight or mostly gay to signify that there really are there are varieties of sexual expression. And it probably pretty much limits our understanding if we just think of it as one or the other. For example, there's some recent research that shows that as many as 10% of young men who identify as straight nevertheless have some component of same-sex attractions, whether that's actually engaging in same-sex behavior or admiring and seeing that particular guys are attractive or even having crushes on other guys. So, and that percent, when you talk about young women, probably goes from 10%. Some would say as high as 30 or 40%. So to sort of say that there are absolutely clearly defined categories really doesn't correspond very much with the scientific literature.
You know, in many biological systems, there's if you look at a particular characteristic, it often comes out close to a bell-shaped curve. And I've never heard sexual orientation in that line. I have read that there's a blurring in between sexes, even there may be a difference between males and females. So, but let me go ahead and ask the question: is it possible, or is there evidence that there's truly a bell-shaped curve for sexual orientation?
Well, certainly not in sort of the traditional way, in the sense that there are as many on the right as on the left, and everyone is bisexual. There's certainly not that.
Okay.
But it is clear that there is more of a sort of a spectrum, if you will. But once again, it depends on what are the choices that you give young people when you're asking them to participate in your research, or when you have them in front of you in your office or at school. And it depends a lot on the question that you ask. For example, far, far more women will say they are bisexual than say that they are lesbian. But on the other hand, among young men, very few will say that they are bisexual, and a lot more will say that they are gay. So there are even some gender differences, even in these in the use of these terms. And certainly there have been well-known lesbians who have had relationships with women and then heterosexually marry. Mm-hmm. So again, these lines are blurred, and that's what makes it difficult, I think, for scientists whenever sure. we do research with this population, and we just sort of assume that we can go to, let's say, a gay organization, and that everybody who is in that gay organization is gay, or that the people who are in that organization are in any sense representative of the much larger population of young men and women who have some degree of same-sex attractions or desires.
Are these differences truly, and again, I understand the difficulty because of the context of these interpretation of these terms, but what I was getting at is there a cultural difference that underlies this? I mean, if there's a connotation about the word gay in one culture as another, is that another complexity that enters into this and why boys may be less likely to identify themselves as having an attraction to the same sex, for example?
I certainly believe that it does. I think this is, and also just in terms of social class or different ethnic and racial groups, and certainly across countries, there are just some mammoth variations in what is implied or what is thought to be. For just as one example, in some culture context, you are only thought to be gay if you were the passive recipient of sex, for mm-hmm. example, mm-hmm. and the more dominant or the assertive would not be considered to be gay. It's just someone who's taking advantage of a situation mm-hmm. for pleasure. So there are these kinds of variations, though I will say we don't really understand them very much at this point. We maybe know a lot more about sex differences as a context than we do about any of these other issues.
Let me remind our listeners briefly, you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection, and my guest today is Dr. Rich Savin-Williams of Cornell University. Our topic is teenagers with sexual attraction to others of the same sex. If you've got questions or comments about the program today, our local number 550-8433, 550-8433. Our email address is line1, and as you should remember, you spell that out, LINEONE at KSKA.org, and our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. Well, because of all this difficulty and preciseness of understanding what people mean and how they may interpret this, I would guess it's difficult to get reliable or repetitive numbers on a percentage of our population that might identify themselves as having different sexual orientation?
Absolutely, and that is a major issue, just to try to think of what is the prevalence of these different categories or these different spots on the continuum. In most cases, and it also depends on the age, because clearly with increasing age, more people come out and thus will identify themselves or will participate in our research. But so, for example, if you go into high schools, you're going to get somewhere around 2-3% of a population of high school students say that they are either gay, lesbian, or bisexual. If, on the other hand, you include the words sort of mostly straight, which implies that you have some component of same-sex sexuality, then you could easily double or triple that number, especially among young women. So, you know, depending on how you define it, you could get 1 or 2% of the population, or you could get 20% of the population. Once again, depending on what it is that you would include in those definitions. So if you ask for identity, you'll get the lowest percent. But if you ask about attractions, you'll probably get the highest percent of same-sex oriented young people. And once again, if you go to a college population, then you can expect those numbers to increase fairly dramatically as more and more young people come out and either declare or are willing to say, this is what I am, once they're sort of freed from sort of the high school culture, if you will.
Are you able to say, given these limitations, that the percentage or the prevalence of individuals that have a same-sex preference or orientation is the same in this decade as it was in the 50s or the 30s? Is this, or is that really impossible to tell?
Well, it's impossible based on science. I mean, I think there's an assumption for most of us that, you know, even though you could not identify young people or young adults in those earlier ages because of the cultural context of what it meant to be gay or lesbian or bisexual, most of us think that it's probably fairly consistent across time and probably across cultures. But I think that's more of an assumption rather than really hardcore scientific research. I think what we do know scientifically is that an increasing number of young people are identifying themselves or declaring their same-sex sexuality at earlier ages. And I think that's pretty well established and I think accepted, so that, you know, the average age of sort of saying to someone else what we call sort of coming out or disclosure to someone else, you know, while in the past that may have been in their 20s, now the average age is probably closer to 15 or 16. The problem with that, of course, is that at that young age, we do not know all the people who will eventually come out. And so that becomes part of the dilemma, is sort of you never know completely who's your total population to know what is the precise age or the average age of disclosure. But I do believe that it is easier for young people today because they know what homosexuality is. You know, if you were to ask that question in my generation, many, many people, including myself, would not have known what that was, what that term was, what it meant, what it implied. Now, if you go into a junior high school and ask how many of you know what homosexuality is, I would say 98% of that middle school class would know what that term meant. And furthermore, if you were to ask many young people, and especially college students, do you know someone who is same-sex oriented or attracted or gay, lesbian, bisexual, in most college classes, 100% will raise their hand. So clearly there's the visibility issue has increased rather dramatically in the last decade.
There's something about when you said the age people will come out that I had not also thought about, and I guess it has to do with different cultures. Are there cultures in the world where that is really not an issue? There's an acceptance right from early childhood of a different orientation, so that the whole idea of coming out means kind of saying that I am different, which, I don't know, I guess a little bit to me bothers me a little bit. We're all a little different, and we're all a lot the same, I guess is what I'm trying to say. So why should we have to come out, so to speak?
Well, there certainly are cultures which are more accepting of homosexuality, and clearly those are, you know, what we like to call Scandinavia or Western Europe, where that's easier to come out and to disclose. But once again, that may vary from family to family and from country to country. And even within our own country, clearly in a lot of ethnic minority groups, it's a little bit more difficult to disclose because of the sort of the pressures on a family or of a system to conform, to get ahead, so that a family member or a parent might say, why do you want to declare this? It'll only hurt you. It will hurt the reputation of the family. Mm-hmm. You won't be able to get a job. So, you know, there are certainly restraints that do handicap young people. But on the other hand, I will say that I certainly have known 8, 9, 10-year-olds who have disclosed their same-sex sexuality. And when I hear other people they too, youth workers or whatever, will say, I've seen that happen too. Which really implies that for a lot of young people, they are disclosing, they are coming out to others while they are still living at home. So they're not waiting necessarily to go to college and then be myself. But they're actually coming out and disclosing while living at home or living, sort of going to school in a local high school or middle school. Clearly not all. I mean, that's clear. But once again, I think perhaps most high schools, most kids in a high school could identify someone or usually more than one young person they know is same-sex oriented.
In some correspondence we had, you corrected me when I used the term sexual preference versus sexual orientation, and I think that may be a good lead-in to this idea of how sexual orientation develops and when it develops. Would you kind of comment on your education of Dr. Woodard on these terms?
Sure. Well, the problem with sexual preference is that it's thought... It's sort of like a selection. Like, I think I will choose who I will be attracted to. And in the field, the scientific field, very, very few scientists actually believe that there's that degree of choice. Now, you can certainly make a decision of whether you will act on it or not. You can certainly make a choice of whether you will accept a gay identity or not. And you can certainly make a decision, you know, about your behavior and so forth. But in terms of your actual sexual attractions and desires and eroticism, most of us believe that there is no choice in that matter. And I think I know, in fact, that most of the scientific evidence is that it is present probably at birth. Now, that could be due to genetics or perhaps to something that's going on in the mother prenatal environment that makes one attracted to members of the same sex. Now, clearly that is not absolutely 100% established that it is present at birth, but in reality, I think it's hard to come up with any other explanation that has any scientific evidence to support it.
Mm-hmm.
So that there's no evidence that it's bad parenting. There is, or good parenting,
mm-hmm.
There is no evidence that it's because you are labeled a certain way that makes you decide, oh, I think I'm going to be that way because everyone thinks I am. So there's no scientific evidence for anything other than present at birth.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which, am I wrong? I mean, almost by default then means there must be some hereditary, that nature is the driving force there, not nurture, not how you're raised, not what your exposures to, or even in utero, let's say.
Well, yes, I mean, clearly, I think there is some that genetics and hereditary have certainly a major role, and I think. But it doesn't. There's no evidence that it counts for 100%.
Mm-hmm.
So that identical twins, it's not true that all identical twins have exactly the same sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that's due to some sort of difference in genetics.
Mm-hmm.
But I think a lot of people also believe, and that's sort of the other half of the scientific debate, is that there's something that is happening inside the mother,
mm-hmm.
during critical periods of brain development. Whether, you know, it used to be thought to be stress or drug intake or alcohol intake or a lot of different things have been suggested. For example, one piece of evidence which is absolutely clear across many cultures and across time is that, and this only works for boys, but with increasing number of older brothers, the younger brothers are more likely to be gay. So that if you have 8 boys in a row,
mm-hmm.
It's very likely that those last-born boys are going to be gay. I mean, their chances of being gay are heightened to a huge extent. So that fact, which is out there, have sort of has led some to believe that there's something that's going on that changes the maternal environment in a way. Maybe perhaps she's producing antibodies to this foreign male fetus that's in her, and the first one or two or three maybe doesn't make much of a difference, but by the fourth or fifth boy or male fetus, she begins to sort of fight this foreign substance in her, perhaps to the extent that it might change some brain organization in this male fetus. Once again, these are only hypotheses at this point, but the evidence is clear. And they've ruled out entirely issues of that it's being raised or postnatal environment, because this is true even when the boys are separated at birth and so forth.
So like identical twins, whether they're raised together or not, it doesn't seem to be a factor, for example.
No, not at all.
Right.
Not at all. Right. So this has been difficult, of course. These facts have become very difficult for people who believe in some kind of a conversion therapy or some kind of way in which they might want to change the sexual orientation of a child or an adolescent or young adult. It becomes very difficult if you sort of say, well, it's been present at birth. It's kind of difficult to change it at after birth.
Is there science on this? And I guess anytime I think about therapy of any sort, whether it's a medication, an over-the-counter, an herb, or something I don't even believe works, there's risks and benefits. And so what do we know about this idea of conversion therapy and evidence for it, and what are the outcomes?
Well, this has been a source of great, great controversy over the last few decades and sort of coming and going over time. The evidence would appear that there are very, very little evidence that you can change the orientation of a child through any kind of therapy. And the therapy usually, I mean, they can involve, at some years ago, they actually involved, sort of severe punishment or very aversive kinds of situations. There are some of which are religiously based. In fact, most probably are. Others maybe not, but clearly there's an agenda to try to make kids more appropriate. There are those who thought, well, if you can change the play behavior, so if you can take away the trucks and the trains from girls, you know, and give them dolls, that kind of reinforcement will eventually make the girl more feminine. And of course, the association is if you make a girl more feminine, then you make them more heterosexual. And that, of course, is, as you and your listeners know, certainly is not a one-to-one correspondence. There are many, many feminine lesbians and some very masculine gay men. So those are the kinds of therapies that people have tried. And what it looks like when you actually look at the data is that you can change how people identify, and you can certainly change their behavior. So you can take a gay man and make him marry, you know, convert him to heterosexual marriage, if you will, and he can perform and have children, but he still has the same kind of erotic desires for men.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you can change behavior, but you can't change the orientation of the person. And I think there's increasing recognition on the part of even some of the conversion therapists because of their failure to do much in terms of long-term changes, that they are more than happy to satisfy with this partial, if you will, effectiveness. The concern of many of us in developmental and clinical psychology is that what is the damage that you're doing to the individual? Rather than helping the individual to accept who she is or becoming comfortable with this aspect of herself or himself, it's that you are putting this kind of barrier, this kind of aversive situation in front of that individual, perhaps at a very young age, that can perhaps grow to be very self-defeating, maybe self-hatred, and create a situation which is not particularly mentally or psychologically healthy. So there is certainly a risk involved in this kind of therapy, and I see no evidence for its success rate, except if you define it in these very narrow ways.
You know, as you think about this, it almost gets down to individualized therapy again, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but I could envision perhaps an individual who may have a sexual orientation to a person of the same sex and yet feel more accepted of themselves or more willing to stay in a bisexual relationship. And then conversely, it might be damaging to try to keep someone in that kind of an arrangement, so that it's almost like you really have to get to know that person and talk to them and have them help you decide how you're going to approach this.
Exactly, and certainly there are some religious traditions, such as the Mormon Church, that makes it extremely difficult to be same-sex oriented and act on it, or to declare it, mm-hmm. because the risk involved is, as I understand it, in many situations, is getting kicked out of the of the church, and perhaps even being condemned to eternal damnation. Mm-hmm. So certainly those consequences are pretty severe. And what is the alternative is maybe leaving the Mormon Church. So and I don't mean to pick on the Mormons, because other pretty religious traditions, right wing, who have those same beliefs.
Right. All right, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection in Anchorage. Our local number is 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Our email address is line1@kska.org. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll continue to talk with Dr. Rich Savin-Williams about teens who have sexual attraction with others of the same sex. You're listening to Line 1. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard.
If you missed part of today's program, or if you'd like to listen again to Line 1, Your Health Connection, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking telephone calls. A copy of today's program will be available on our website at kska.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, Your Health Connection, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is Dr. Rich Savin-Williams. He's professor and chair of human development at Cornell University, and our topic is teens with sexual attraction to others of the same sex. If you've got questions or comments, we're going to be around about another close to 30 minutes. Our email address is line1@kska.org. Our phone number locally, 550-8433, and our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And please remember, at any time, you can listen to this program by going to ksKA.org/line1 and look at our archive, or you can refer someone to the program. And also remember, after if you're listening between 7 and 8 on Monday nights, you're listening to a recorded broadcast, and we won't be able to answer questions. One more question about this development of orientation. Then I want to get into some of the psychosocial aspects and parenting issues and how to help teens with these issues. What age, and you've kind of addressed this a little bit, what age do children typically become aware of their orientation and the fact that they may be in the minority as to their orientation?
Well, of course, we're not allowed to ask children these questions, which is unfortunate because, as a result, all of our information is retrospective. But when you ask young people, say, college age, or once they reach the age of 16, 17, and 18, and we can ask these kinds of questions, most will report a very early age. And for many of these young people, they recall these kinds of feelings, though they didn't label them at the time as sexual or romantic, from first memories. So they're there, they're present, they are just felt to be normal, at least certainly initially on the part of these young people, because that's what they're all about. They've never known any other feelings other than same-sex oriented. Certainly, the average age is, when you ask retrospectively, is about age 7 or 8. So we're talking about second or third grader as a first memory of having a same-sex attraction or a same-sex crush or same-sex behavior or feelings. Certainly, it's before puberty for the vast majority of the people that we've asked. So it's present from a very early age, and certainly puberty doesn't begin it. What we think is probably puberty has an effect of sort of eroticizing it and making it much more intense. But the feelings are there. The behavior could be there, but probably not likely from a very, very early age.
Okay. We have a caller. I want to take that phone call before we continue with my questions. Fred, you're on line one.
Yes. And I came, I first became aware when I was probably 9 and then was pretty certain by the age of 15 and then tried very hard to be straight and actually was in a marriage for 20 years. But my question is that I have two friends, one of whom says that he really became aware of his attraction to men at age 35, and another who says that that happened at age 40. And I'm just wondering, is there any data about the age of awareness in older men when they look back and even though they have been in a heterosexual relationship all their lives?
Very good point. And unfortunately, my answer is not going to be very satisfying. But we know actually very, very little about these kinds of experiences of coming out in later life. We certainly know that there have been women, and we've heard some reports certainly of women who sort of after a marriage, they once freed from sort of this heterosexual life that they have been leading, sort of say, actually, I've find women very attractive, and I think now that I will act on it. I will say that most of the men and women my age who are, say, 60, are in heterosexual marriages at the time. Clearly, there's a generational issue here where people do not recognize, perhaps until an older age, about what their feelings and attractions have meant. Now, does this mean that their feelings are new, that they've never had these feelings before, or is it that they didn't define them or didn't allow themselves to feel it? And I think those are very, very interesting research questions, but we don't know the answer to that at this point.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Yeah.
You're welcome.
My friend said, one of my friends said that when he came out at 35, his mother said, oh, I could have told you that when you were 8.
That's actually a very interesting point because we may get more into talking about parents and families. But what strikes me is that when you actually talk with young people and with parents, you'll get a similar story to that, which is that they may act surprised or shocked or whatever. But when you actually sit down in a calmer, you know, sort of a calmer mood and you go, didn't you sort of have some inclination? And a lot of mothers will say, well, now that you mention it, there is da-da-da-da-da-da. And then they mention all these things which clearly indicate some knowledge. Sadly, fathers do not appear to be quite as aware of the sexuality of their child as the mother. Hopefully that is changing over time as more fathers get involved in parenting.
All right, Fred, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Along that same line, I would maybe argue with you a little bit in that I recall talking about gender orientation or gender selection maybe with somebody several years ago on the program, and they mentioned that it's also not necessarily predictive of the behavior of a boy or a girl early in childhood of outcome. For example, a boy who enjoys dancing, enjoys dresses, enjoys playing with other girls may or may not end up with the same sexual attraction as that appears to be leading. Would you agree with that statement?
Totally, I would agree. We know from science that if you are what we call sort of your gender expression is gender atypical or another term we use is, excuse me, is gender nonconforming, then the odds of you being same-sex attracted are not perfect, but they're clearly high, and much higher than for heterosexually oriented people. But it's not a one-to-one correspondence. So I do agree that it's not an absolute thing. But it is highly, highly predictive. And I think the more you are on the gender atypicality side of things, the more likely that you will have same-sex attracted, will be same-sex attracted. So that when a parent asks me for advice because their male child is dressing in high heels, he's playing with dolls and so forth, and she wants to know two questions, will he be gay and what can I do to change it? And my first answer is always, the likelihood is very, very great that he will be gay. The second is that there's nothing you can do to change it.
Mm-hmm.
But I could be wrong.
Mm-hmm. We have an email. You'd mentioned earlier that later born boys, younger boys of multiple boys in a family have a higher likelihood of being gay. The question is the same true for girls?
No, we can find no correlation at all. And perhaps this is because a female fetus is not a foreign substance in the mother's womb. So there's no antibodies, antigens, anything at all to fight it because it's like, oh, I recognize this. I'm one of this. So, no. No relationship at all for girls.
Let's talk a little bit about parenting and development. And although this is about teens, let's start with children 7 or 8, when you said many kids are beginning to understand and appreciate their sexual orientation and how they may be in a minority. What are the important things for parents to hear about helping that child develop healthily, psychologically?
Well, I have a sort of a standard line, which I still believe pretty strongly, which is to me that if one loves one's child, then you love that child unconditionally.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say to parents, if this is true for you, then you will love your child regardless of her or his sexual orientation, and that you will supply a loving, supporting home for that child, and that you will be there. Granted, there may be extra parental needs that you may have to do. For example, you may have to be an advocate at schools to make sure that schools and other institutions, such as your religious institution, be supportive and to protect the child, your child, in order for her or him to grow up to be healthy. So I think that's a sort of a primary, those are sort of primary goals I think a parent should have, which is to be supportive and to be loving and caring and an advocate for your child. Now, I would also want to tell the parent that it's very likely that you're not going to be able to do anything to change that orientation, that it is there. You can teach your child to hate himself or herself and to suppress it and not to recognize what it is. You certainly have that obligation, I think, that possibility. I think there are some negative consequences to that. But I think that, there's just very little you can do. I don't think there's much to do in terms of your parenting. I think that you probably have parented just the same way as any other parent, so it's not, quote-unquote, your fault. And I think maybe my third major point would be that while in the past there might be some very realistic concerns that the life of that child growing up to be same-sex oriented and identifiable might be hazardous to the health of that child, I think we're growing in the direction where that's no longer the case. That is, that with the cultural acceptance and tolerance, that now being same-sex oriented is not nearly the negative that it once was. Now, that doesn't mean the world is perfect. It doesn't mean that everything is safe. But I think that with the increasing visibility of same-sex oriented people in business and sports, even in entertainment, that there are a lot of options of growing up and being successful in whatever way that implies for a particular kid.
Yeah, that's interesting. It was a comment I was going to ask you, is what are the driving motive forces? What are the principal ones that you can think of that have driven this increased awareness? I think back, was it the recognition of the problems with civil rights? Is it the media? Is it education? What are the driving factors in this change?
Well, certainly, first and foremost, has to be the incredible effort that early gay advocates, gay and lesbian bisexual advocates, made to be treated as individuals and respectful and so forth. So there's been a lot of civil rights oriented individuals who have done incredible good to change our culture, to make our culture more aware. And I think part of their work has been to create a media that has been incredible in presenting positive images of gay, lesbian, bisexual individuals. And it's not hard at all to think of even soap operas, of reality television. On every station that you can imagine, there's visibility. And I think what comes visibility becomes people feeling more able to come out, to be public. And one of the there are two best predictors of positive attitudes towards gay, lesbian, bisexual people, one of which is believing it's biologically based and not a matter of choice. And the second major predictor is knowing someone who is gay, lesbian, or bisexual. So it's sort of as more people come out, more people are aware, and they go, oh, I love my uncle, or I love my sister, or I love my mother or my grandmother, and they're gay, lesbian, or bisexual. Must be that's not such a horrible thing.
Adolescence is typically thought of as a time when individuals are striving for independence and figuring themselves out and accepting themselves. Is it true that children with some problems with or differences in sexual orientation have more problems, more difficulties during adolescence that might lead to risk-taking behavior such as suicides or hurting themselves and drugs and so forth?
Well, this has been one of the major issues in the media lately, and there's a lot of controversy around that. And part of this has to do with a topic that we discussed earlier in the show, which is who is out there to be identified, and are they representative of the total population? So there clearly has been a focus on the suicidality and depression and anxiety of young people with same-sex attractions. I do not find convincing evidence that those individuals are necessarily representative of the much larger population of same-sex attracted youth. So, and I think a good indication of that is that as our population gets more representative of the total population, then the suicidality or depression goes down rather dramatically. So that at one point, for example, we were saying that a third or a half of all kids who are gay, lesbian, or bisexual attempt suicide. And I do want to add, we know nothing at all about actual suicides here. It's only attempted suicides that we know anything at all about. So 30, 40, 50%. Now, on the other hand, it's closer to 20 or 15%, and some would even say 10%. So the percentages have come way down as we get better populations and as the culture becomes more positive and supportive. Now, there. So that's, I think, part of the issue. My desire would be that we spend less time on the pathology or the mental health problems of gay, lesbian, bisexual youth and far more time talking about their unique contributions to our culture, to talk about their health, their strength, their power, and those kind of more positive aspects of their lives. And it's interesting to me that we have not at all emphasized that point, which is an issue that I think would be good for them. I think it would be good to give a young person who is struggling with these feelings and attractions and not quite sure what they mean or whether they should talk about them. And if the only image they have out there is one of suicidality and depression, then I don't think that's a positive message to deliver to kids, as opposed to one that is saying, oh, look at these, look how healthy you can be. Look what a normal life you can have by declaring your sexuality. So I do worry a lot about suicide contagion by putting the message out there that kids who would not normally attempt suicide might actually go that route because that is the image that they have.
Yeah, so we got kind of a selection bias problem, and then the other issue is you're saying we need to be more more positive about all the positive things associated with adolescence and even your sexual orientation.
Exactly. You know, there's some interesting data out there which shows that young gay men, when you compare their suicidality and depression with straight men, they look worse. But if you compare them to girls, they actually don't look bad at all. Mm-hmm. So that it's, you know, and if indeed they have a brain structure to some extent, which is more similar to young women, then it makes you wonder, like, what is the proper comparison to talk about their mental health problems? It may be simply that young men, like young women, young gay men, similar to young straight women, are more likely to be introspective, to be sensitive, to think about and feel and to report in a particular way. And for women, it's pretty easy to get rid of the difference in suicidality or depression by simply omitting a small subgroup of bisexual women who are not really bisexual women as much as they are heterosexual women who are identifying as bisexual as a part of their larger problems of mental health. Mm-hmm. So they sexualize their life, even to the sense of their identity, when they're really not attracted to women.
We've got about 10 minutes left, and let me apologize for not giving our phone numbers again. This is Line 1. My guest is Dr. Rich Savin-Williams, and we're talking about adolescents with same-sex orientation. If you've got questions or comments, we'll be here for about 10 more minutes. 550-8433 is our local number, 550-8433. Line 1 at KSKA.org is our email, and our long distance or toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. Here's another email question. A listener has heard an explanation given on the Discovery Channel that how people develop their sexual orientation seems to be related to when genitalia develop in the fetus. Its brain, it's neutral. So the point is that she's heard that the brain is neutral when the genitalia develop. If the male fetus needs a dose of estrogen to create a male brain, but instead receives some exposure to estrogen, then they may create more of a female brain in a male body and vice versa. What's your thoughts or comments on this?
Well, that is certainly an explanation that has been given, or at least it's a very good working hypothesis, and I think it certainly could very easily account for some portion of those who are same-sex oriented. I think the point might be, the more interesting point is that there are maybe multiple ways of getting to the same endpoint, so that the brain that is changing at a critical moment during sort of the first trimester, as the emailer is indicating, that may be due to some kind of genetic functioning, or it may be due to, once again, some prenatal environmental issue. So, once again, there may be different ways of getting to the same endpoint, and the research in this area is still very much in its infancy, but I think the lines of inquiry are going in the same direction.
Okay. Got a couple more emails I want to try to get to, and this is a question that says, I just caught a bit of your discussion and wondered if you were addressing confusions that seem to exist among many conservative people mixing gender issues with sexual orientation. I find this to be a huge tripping hazard for people. It seems to be empowering to come out as a gay man, but to come out as a trans woman can be dangerous. Along these same lines, a gay man or a butch lesbian might be picked out for harassment, but on the basis of their gender presentation, not orientation. Just a thought. Love your show. Can't wait to hear it until the entirety tonight.
Well, that is exactly my point of view, which is that most of the bullying, most of the harassment that goes on in our culture today is based on gender expression, not on sexual orientation. So that it's not that a middle school kid is saying, "Oh, I'm going to harass you because you're going home and masturbating to male or same-sex images." It's that you are not acting in the way that I think you should be acting, in the same way that I don't like annoying personalities, or I don't like an overweight person, or I don't like an Asian American. That is, that you stand out as being different in a way that I don't approve of. So I actually believe that if we could solve the gender expression problem, we would solve the problem in many ways. And I think this is the dilemma that absolutely those who are trying to stop bullying face, I think, is to stop this kind of behavior.
And one more email. The quote is, "We need to all support children who know they are gay. My former spouse finally came out as a gay man. He knew since age 5 that he was gay, but he felt forced to live in a lie in a heterosexual marriage. It took a toll on his physical health, and he was unable to have an intimate relation with me. We were married 23 years with 2 children. The toll this took on my marriage and my children was great. It's taken years for me to come to terms with it. I hope that all people who know that they are gay will honor their orientation, and culture at large will allow each person to live lives in a way that they were meant to."
And I'm optimistic that our culture is changing exactly in that direction. And I think it's probably the best time in our culture to be young and gay. The culture is changing rather dramatically. We're now over the 50% mark for support of same-sex marriage. We support gays in the military. The percent who find homosexuality an acceptable way of life is dramatically increasing over the last decade. And so all of this, and you can almost track this by age. So the younger you are, the more likely you are to be in favor of gay rights and finding gay people to be just normal and ordinary. So I think there's great hope with the younger generation. And I think even, some political conservatives say, basically, I have no problems with same-sex sexuality. So I don't think it's just simply a political orientation. I think it's across the landscape that you will find growing acceptance. I just wish I had it when I was growing up, and I'm very happy that the young people today have it.
How about advice for pediatricians, family practitioners that are dealing with adolescents about sexuality? Let me bring my compatriots into this discussion.
Right. Well, I think what is very important for any doctor is not to make assumptions about the sexuality of the patient, and to treat the patient and the sexuality in a very respectful way. I don't think necessarily that young people who are same-sex oriented have different biological or medical needs. I think they have many of the same needs, and I think that as much as they feel that their pediatrician is accepting, whether it's that they have gay posters on their wall or gay books or some indication that there's a welcoming environment for them to talk about these kinds of issues in a way that is straightforward and respectful, and that they could trust the pediatrician to keep whatever information, the young person wants, sort of private.
Maybe a more general question. I'll direct it towards adolescents who are having some sexual orientation concerns themselves and worries. But what would be signs that would be should be alerting to parents that the adolescents may be needing some help?
Well, I think certainly in probably the same way that almost any young person would. I don't know necessarily that there are some huge differences. I mean, clearly signs of depression, clearly signs of anxiety, or feeling that they have to go out and sort of prove their sexuality would be sort of big red flags for me. And I think in the sense of if a kid is telling a lot of homophobic jokes, gay jokes, or is totally uncomfortable with the topic, there is some evidence that indicates that that may be an indication that they are struggling themselves with the with these kinds of issues. So I think parents or anyone who can sort of talk about these kinds of issues, I don't believe so much in forcing a child out of the closet, but I certainly think creating an environment where the parent is willing to talk about these issues with statements, you know, like, you know, to that sound pro-gay, or at least that it's okay. It's just normal. It's a normal expression of sexuality.
We have a couple of minutes left, and I always like to ask, what are misconceptions? Is there one or two misconceptions that still bother you about gay, lesbian, bisexual teens in particular?
I think the biggest one for me is that they are suicidal necessarily.
Okay.
Or that they are going to have miserable lives, or that they are condemned to not being able to have fulfilling lives. I just think that those are the kinds of things that I would love to get rid of as soon as possible. I would also like, and this may go against the grain of some of your listeners, but it's not so much that I do like Dan Savage's It Gets Better, but I'm video, YouTube kind of thing. But I'm actually concerned, I think my message would rather be, it's better right now. You know, live your life now to have a holistic life of expressing however you feel comfortable with your sexuality, and not wait, not hold off until you're away from home or until you're older. But I think now, if possible, as much as possible, to live the kind of life that you feel is authentic and yours now for the present. So I hate putting it off, and I'm not so sure that's a good message to deliver to young people, except for some, clearly, who are in an environment or a situation where they just can't escape a very negative situation.
Mm-hmm. So as much positive feedback always helps, as much as we can structure the relationship, structure the interactions of people, more and more positive interactions, and leads to more and more positive attitudes, I guess, is something I've heard psychologists say somewhere.
Right, and that it's natural. Mm-hmm. And I think that's very important.
Okay.
And by natural, it just simply means it's typical, it's normal, it's normal sexuality.
Okay. Well, it's been a pleasure. It's been a fast hour for me. I very much appreciate your taking the time, Dr. Savin Williams.
Well, I appreciate your listeners and the opportunity to talk about these very critical issues.
All right. Perhaps we'll have you on again. I think this is another topic we could do several programs on. So thanks again.
You're welcome.
Next week, we're going to return Monday afternoon, May 23rd at 2 p.m., and we'll have a local guest, Anchorage pediatric surgeon Dr. Brent Roten, and we'll be discussing the advantages of having pediatric surgery available in Alaska. So why don't you join us at that time? Pat Yak is Vice President of Public Media. Kristen Spack engineered the program today. Thanks for listening, especially to those who called and emailed. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1, Your Health Connection, is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available on our website at kska.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.